July 5th, 2000. Seabrook, New Hampshire. Curtis Bichon, a 40-year-old former police officer suffering from multiple sclerosis, is working the graveyard shift as a factory security guard when his car suddenly catches fire. The fire department shows up to handle the situation, but less than 2 hours after they leave, Curtis inexplicably vanishes from the premises. Years later, a former factory worker allegedly brags about causing Curtis's disappearance, and even though it is theorized that Curtis was killed after interrupting a theft, there is no evidence to arrest anyone, and no trace of Curtis is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a missing persons case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 2000 disappearance of Curtis Bichon. This is the tragic story of a man who wanted nothing more than to become a police officer, and was successfully following his dream before his life was derailed by multiple sclerosis. Because of his physical limitations, Curtis had to leave the police force and eventually got a job as a security guard at a factory, but while in the midst of working the graveyard shift one night, he vanished without a trace. The circumstances of Curtis's disappearance are very strange, as his car inexplicably caught fire in the middle of his shift a few hours before he went missing. Since Curtis's multiple sclerosis caused him to struggle with depression, there was speculation that the car fire may have been his breaking point, which caused him to go off somewhere and take his own life. However, as the years have gone by, investigators are now leaning towards the theory that Curtis was the victim of foul play, and that one or more of his co-workers from the factory were responsible. As it stands right now, it sounds like this is one of those cases where law enforcement just lacks that one key piece of evidence to make an arrest. Ever since the inception of this podcast, I have received a number of requests to cover this story, and given that we passed the 20th anniversary of Curtis's disappearance 3 months ago, I thought now would be an ideal time to put together an episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved disappearance of Curtis Bichon. Our story begins in 2000, and our central figure is 40-year-old Curtis Bichon. Curtis grew up alongside two brothers and a sister, and their father, Nicholas Bichon, worked as a military police investigator. Even though the Bichon family originally hailed from New Hampshire, Nicholas's job required him to move around a lot during Curtis's childhood, so Curtis wound up graduating from high school in Hawaii and decided to attend university there. However, ever since he was a boy, the only thing Curtis really wanted to do was work in law enforcement, so he would quickly drop out of university and move back to New Hampshire to pursue that career. Since he was still too young to join the police academy, he worked as an emergency dispatcher for 2 years before joining the army, where he served as a military police officer in Korea. Following his return to the US, Curtis finally achieved his dream when he was hired as a patrol officer at the Concord Police Department in 1984. He would enjoy a successful career until the 1990s, when he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, a muscular disorder which left him in frequent pain and made it difficult for him to walk. The disease eventually progressed to the point that it was impossible for Curtis to fire his gun accurately, so he was forced to retire from the police force in 1994. According to Curtis's family, his personality completely changed as he became very withdrawn and depressed about his situation. While he collected a police pension, Curtis had trouble securing and holding down a new steady job, and he seemed unsure about what to do with his life. He wound up moving into a residential hotel in the town of Hampton and rarely spent much time socializing. In the past, Curtis had issues with drinking, which caused him to do a stint in rehab during his time on the police force, but his condition would only cause his drinking to worsen. At one point, he got a job as a security guard, but wound up getting fired after showing up drunk for one of his shifts. However, by the end of 1998, Curtis was able to pull his act together enough to get hired by the Reliable Security Guard Agency, and he was given a new job in Seabrook, a small town of approximately 8,000 people located right next to the New Hampshire-Massachusetts border. Curtis was assigned to work the graveyard shift at a factory for the Venture Corporation, which manufactured plastic parts for automobiles, and the position only entailed limited mobility and did not require him to carry a gun. He would work from 9:30 p.m. until 5:30 a.m., and his scheduled shift for July the 4th, 2000, seemed like it was going to be less busy than usual. Under normal circumstances, around 100 employees would have been working inside the factory during the graveyard shift, but since a number of people were celebrating the 4th of July holiday, this was considered to be a quote-unquote shutdown week, so a skeleton crew of only 12 workers were there that night. They said that Curtis appeared to be in good spirits when he arrived for a shift, and at around midnight on July the 5th, the factory security supervisor checked in with Curtis at the guard shack where he was stationed and said that everything seemed normal. However, at 1:42 a.m., Curtis contacted the local fire department and told them his car was on fire. When he attempted to use a fire extinguisher to put it out on his own, he realized that the flames were too strong, so when the fire department arrived, they managed to douse them. Since the car was parked only 8 feet away from the guard shack, the flames wound up singeing the walls, but Curtis claimed to have no idea how the fire started. The department's deputy chief would later say that Curtis appeared to be unusually stoic and calm about the whole situation, but in spite of the loss of his vehicle, he would continue on working his shift after they left. The security supervisor stopped by to check in on Curtis again at 3:25 a.m. and noticed the burned-out vehicle, but he thought that Curtis seemed to be all right. But sometime within the next 20 minutes, Curtis would vanish without a trace. At around 3:45, one of the factory workers noticed that Curtis was not at his station. Even though his cigarettes, packed lunch, glasses, and contact lens solution were inside the guard shack, and his car was still parked nearby, Curtis himself was nowhere to be found. By the time the security guard for the next ship showed up to relieve Curtis at 5:30, he had still not turned up. When a search of the factory failed to find him, the Seabrook Police Department were notified, and Curtis was officially reported missing. The police would perform their own search of the factory and the surrounding area, but they also had no success. The last entry in Curtis's logbook was written at around 2 a.m. after the fire department arrived at the scene. Other than the security supervisor, the last people who could confirm seeing Curtis were a group of workers who had been taking a break at around 3:15, and they said they saw Curtis walking around the facility, something he didn't do that often because of his MS. Sometime between 3:30 and 3:45, a night shift foreman also recalled seeing two vehicles speeding out of the factory's driveway, but he didn't get a clear enough look at them to provide a description, and it was unclear if this had any connection to Curtis's disappearance. Well, when investigators spoke to Curtis's family, they learned that he had expressed concern to them about possible illegal activity, such as drug deals, taking place in the factory's parking lot. On previous occasions, he told them he feared for his personal safety at his job, and a co-worker apparently once threatened to kill him over a parking ticket Curtis had written. Curtis had also claimed that he felt threatened by some Hispanic workers at the factory because he was interested in a Latina woman who worked there. Interestingly enough, nearly 4 hours before Curtis went missing, a factory employee noticed two cars parked at the Extra Mart across the street. The vehicles contained Hispanic individuals, and they appeared to be acting rowdy. Since the skeleton crew was working at the factory that night, Curtis was concerned about the fact that he was not going to have any backup. Sure enough, it turned out that a pair of vending machines and a change machine located near the cafeteria were vandalized during Curtis's final shift, and a padlocked door to a union office normally used for storage had been kicked in. Investigators were unable to determine who caused this damage or if it had any relation to what happened to Curtis. According to Curtis's father, Nicholas Bichon, on July the 3rd, the day before his final shift, Curtis purchased a 9mm gun from him for $200. The gun had originally belonged to Curtis, and he had a legal permit to carry it, but due to financial difficulties, he had sold the weapon to his father years earlier. Given Curtis's history of depression, it wasn't long before investigators started exploring the possibility that he had bought the gun back because he intended on taking his own life, and perhaps the mysterious car fire was his breaking point. While there didn't seem to be any sign of accelerant in or around Curtis's vehicle, the insurance investigators concluded that arson had taken place. Curtis had a habit of storing many of his favorite personal possessions inside the vehicle, but most of them wound up being destroyed when the fire occurred. This led to speculation that the incident caused Curtis to suffer some sort of mental breakdown, which prompted him to walk away from the factory and shoot himself. However, this theory was discounted when Curtis's gun was located inside his residential hotel room, so he was definitely not carrying it with him during his final shift. In spite of his struggles with MS, Curtis did not give off any signs of being depressed or suicidal at the time he disappeared, as he had been making plans to purchase a new car that week and was looking forward to a family vacation later that month. But no matter what Curtis's mental state might have been, the biggest problem with the theory that he wandered off the factory grounds is that his condition would have prevented him from walking very far. Even if he had planned on hitchhiking out of the area, it still would have required him to make a long walk from the guard shack to the nearest road. There was no record of any deliveries made to the factory during Curtis's shift, or any company trucks leaving the facility that he could have hitched a ride with. No taxis were summoned to pick up anyone there that night, and since phone records from Curtis's hotel room showed that the only calls he made prior to his disappearance were to his mother, it seemed unlikely that he called anyone to arrange a ride. Since Curtis was a smoker, and his cigarettes were left behind in the guard shack, his family believed that was strong enough evidence to show that he did not leave of his own volition. Investigators did look into the co-worker from the factory, whom Curtis claimed had threatened him, but it turned out he had an alibi that night, and he denied that these threats ever took place. They also explored the possibility that Curtis's disappearance might have been related to his previous career as a police officer. During his time with the Concord Police Department, he mostly worked as a street officer who was not involved in violent crime investigations, but he had also supposedly conducted affairs with the wives of at least two of his fellow officers. But in the end, no evidence was found to suggest this had any relevance to what happened to him. There would be no further activity on Curtis's bank accounts and social security number, and his disappearance would prove so baffling that it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in October of 2001. In 2008, Curtis's family had him declared legally deceased, but a major development would take place in October of that year when a 40-year-old man named Robert April III was arrested. April had allegedly grabbed a 17-year-old kid named David Horvitz and threatened to kill his family because Horvitz's brother owed him $30. According to Horvitz, April stated, quote, "When I see your brother boy, I'm going to slice his throat and nobody will find his body, just like the missing person from Seabrook. Yeah, that's right, I killed him, and your brother is next, and nobody will find an ounce of blood. I buried him in my yard, and your brother's next," end quote. Well, April just happened to be a former employee with Venture Corporation, and was one of the skeleton crew working the graveyard shift at the factory on the night Curtis disappeared, so it seemed very likely that Curtis was the missing person April was referring to in his threats. Months later, April would go on trial in Hampton District Court for the charges of criminal threatening and simple assault, but the judge would find him not guilty after David Horvitz recanted his original story on the witness stand. But it would turn out that Horvitz was far from the only person who had supposedly heard April brag about his involvement in Curtis's disappearance. Around this time period, the Pashon family would launch their Find Kurt campaign, putting together a website about his case at findkurt.com and offering an anonymous telephone tip line. Well, at one point, they received an anonymous call from a person who claimed they were told by two people that the alleged perpetrator had confessed about Curtis's murder to them. Curtis had supposedly caught this person stealing at the factory, so they responded by beating him to death. Curtis's body was then hidden inside the union office before the perpetrator could smuggle it out of the factory, and the body was later dismembered before it was buried in the perpetrator's yard. In 2010, the authorities spent 2 days excavating a cement slab behind a residence in Seabrook. The property had once belonged to Robert April's brother before he died 5 years earlier, but even though the new owners gave permission for a search, it failed to turn up anything. Around this time period, the investigation was headed by Seabrook Police Lieutenant Mike Gallagher, who publicly expressed his belief that the fire in Curtis's car was started by two factory workers to create a diversion while they attempted to use forklifts to break into the two damaged vending machines and change machine in order to steal money from them. But at some point, Curtis caught them in the act and was killed for it. While Gallagher believed that Curtis's death was likely an accident and the responsible party did not intend to kill him, he also stated, quote, "I think the community knows what happened. Everyone knows that we know. The people who did it know that we know they did it. He's a local. I think he stays in his trailer, maybe on a self-imposed prison term, so maybe there's a little justice there." End quote. While Robert April is the primary person of interest, Gallagher confirmed there was at least one other person of interest who was also working the same graveyard shift at the factory that night, but their name has never been released publicly. However, Gallagher said the main reason an arrest has never been made is because the only evidence against the alleged perpetrators are, quote-unquote, third-person accounts. And since most of the tips law enforcement and the Pashon family received have been anonymous, they cannot be used as evidence or probable cause to secure the necessary warrants for a search or an arrest. Even though Curtis's body has never been found, his family has still set up a memorial stone for him at the New Hampshire State Veterans Cemetery in Boscawen. The Pashons have offered a $10,000 reward for information which leads to the recovery of Curtis's body and the arrest and conviction of the responsible party, but after 20 years, he continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, when I first became familiar with this case after seeing it on Unsolved Mysteries many years ago, I thought it was a truly perplexing mystery. As you probably know, one of the most memorable stories the show ever featured, which I've also covered on this podcast, was the 1987 disappearance of Dale Kerstetter, another case involving a security guard who went missing while working a graveyard shift at a factory. Like Curtis Pashon, Dale Kerstetter may have been murdered because he interrupted a theft, but while it was fairly easy to formulate a number of theories about what happened in that case, Curtis's disappearance did not seem to make any sense. The most bizarre detail was undoubtedly Curtis's car catching on fire in the middle of his shift only about 2 hours before he went missing, and while the two events were most likely connected, it was just very difficult to figure out how they might have transpired. The Unsolved Mysteries segment has a lot more ambiguity about whether Curtis was the victim of foul play or if he might have wandered away from the scene voluntarily and ended his own life somewhere. However, as the years have gone by, the ambiguity has faded away, and it now seems like this is one of those cases where law enforcement has a pretty good idea about what happened and who was responsible, but they just lack the evidence to make an arrest. But even so, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about how these events might have played out. Before he even went missing, it sounds like Curtis's life story was already a pretty tragic one, as working as a police officer was pretty much the only thing he ever wanted to do, but due to circumstances beyond his control, he was forced to end his career early. Multiple sclerosis is already such a horrible disease to live with, but it's got to be extra devastating when it prevents you from doing the one thing you love most. And this is the main reason that people could not initially dismiss the possibility of Curtis's disappearance being a suicide. It sounds like working as a security guard did give Curtis some purpose, but I'm sure he was still suffering. Apparently, after his shift ended every morning, it was pretty much his daily routine to go across the street to the Extra Mart to purchase a 12-pack of beer before he headed back to his hotel room to watch pornography, get drunk, and pass out. So he obviously kept experiencing a lot of regret about how his life turned out. Given that many of Curtis's personal possessions were destroyed when his car caught fire, there was speculation that this breaking point might have caused him to either become suicidal or suffer some sort of mental breakdown before he wandered off. If he jumped into a body of water or found an isolated place to end his life, that could explain why his body was never found. Well, even though that theory might be plausible in some cases, it's hard to imagine a person with MS being able to make it that far, as the disease really makes it difficult to walk long distances. The only conceivable way for him to have made it out of the area undetected is if he hitchhiked, but the distance from the guard shack to the main road still would have made it a challenge for someone in Curtis's condition. The fact that Curtis bought back a gun from his father only a day and a half before he went missing could be seen as a major red flag that he was contemplating suicide, but since the gun was ultimately found in Curtis's hotel room, I'm sure it doesn't have any relevance to his disappearance. So I definitely think that the only way Curtis left the Venture Corporation premises is if someone abducted him or he was already dead. When the Unsolved Mysteries segment originally aired in 2001, there was a lot more uncertainty about what actually happened to Curtis, but it sounds like things changed when Seabrook Police Lieutenant Mike Gallagher took over the case a few years later. During Curtis's tenure at Venture Corporation, Gallagher was working as a patrolman and said that he sometimes stopped by the factory during his patrols to chat with Curtis in the guard shack and thought he was a nice guy. When Gallagher started working the investigation, he received an anonymous tip advising him to look closer at the skeleton crew who was working at the factory during Curtis's final shift. Under normal circumstances, there would have been at least 100 people working that shift, and it would have been very difficult for an employee to abduct or murder Curtis without anyone noticing. However, because this was the 4th of July holiday, and there were only 12 employees working there that night, including Curtis, it's not implausible that one or more of them could have gotten away with something like that. Of course, Curtis's family have claimed that prior to his disappearance, he told them that he felt unsafe because there was illegal activity taking place at the factory, and one of his co-workers had supposedly threatened him for giving him a parking ticket. Now, we know that the primary person of interest, Robert April III, worked there, and was one of the 12 employees who was present on the night Curtis went missing. However, I'm not sure if April was the same co-worker whom Curtis had accused of threatening him, because it's been reported that this employee had an alibi, which might imply that he was not working at the factory that night. But interestingly enough, before Lieutenant Gallagher took over the investigation, he says that one of the people who had been most adamant about pushing forward the theory that Curtis went off somewhere and took his own life is the same person he now suspects of committing the crime. If true, it definitely sounds like that was an act of intentional misdirection. Given what we know now, there's some leads in this case which ultimately turned out to mean nothing, like the allegations of drug dealing in the factory parking lot, the sighting of the Hispanic individuals acting rowdy at the Extra Mart across the street, and the allegations that Curtis had affairs with some police officers' wives during his time on the force. The most significant clue seems to be the vandalism of the vending machines at the factory, and I always thought that detail was downplayed a bit during the original Unsolved Mysteries segment. The car fire and this vandalism taking place on the shift when Curtis went missing just seems like a few too many coincidences. While the primary theory seems to be that Curtis was killed while interrupting the theft of some vending machines, it's not entirely clear to me if anything was actually stolen that night. It's possible that if the actual theft was halted because they needed to dispose of Curtis's body, the perpetrator or perpetrators never actually got the chance to steal anything out of the machines. Curtis had previously expressed his concern that because a skeleton crew was working that night, he would have no backup if any problems arose. With the only security being an immobile man with MS, I wouldn't be surprised if the responsible party thought this would be the perfect opportunity for a theft, but things still went horribly wrong. Now, before I talk any more about this theory, I should mention that the Venture Corporation factory would close down less than 4 years after Curtis went missing, and it sounds like there was a lot of shadiness going on in this company. The main reason the factory wound up closing is because Venture Corporation's owner, Larry Wingett, was involved in a scandal where he and his family siphoned more than $314 million from the company before it went into bankruptcy. And in 2003, the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration fined the company $55,000 for serious safety violations after a worker at the Seabrook factory was killed when a large mold slipped from a horizontal mold injection machine and crushed him. Long story short, this did sound like a bit of a dysfunctional workplace, so employees breaking into vending machines in the middle of a shift does not sound like a stretch. But how does this explain the strange fire which engulfed Curtis's car? I have to admit, that part of the story still baffles me. The theory provided by Lieutenant Gallagher is that the fire was started by the perpetrators as a diversion while they orchestrated their theft. After all, it's believed that they used a forklift to break into the vending machines, which would have created a lot of noise, so perhaps they felt the fire would keep Curtis occupied. However, the problem is that Curtis's car was parked only 8 feet away from the guard shack where he was stationed, so how did he not notice this? I mean, I guess he could have been somewhere else at the time, but like I've mentioned on numerous occasions, Curtis's MS made it very difficult for him to walk. In fact, while it was standard practice for security guards to do their rounds and walk the perimeter at the start of their shifts, on this particular night, the guard whom Curtis relieved offered to do it because he knew that sort of thing was difficult for him. Did someone manage to set fire to Curtis's car while he was 8 feet away without him noticing? I guess it's possible, but even though the insurance investigators believe that arson had taken place, I'm not sure if they were able to determine how exactly the fire was started. A lot has been made of the fact that Curtis seemed unusually calm when the fire department was putting out the flames, but this could be explained by the fact that he was looking into purchasing a new vehicle sometime in the near future. In fact, once I learned that piece of information, I wondered if perhaps Curtis might have started the fire himself for insurance reasons, since he would not need that car for much longer. But since many of Curtis's favorite possessions were inside the vehicle and wound up being destroyed, that makes it less likely he was responsible, and it's just too much of a coincidence that he would go missing shortly thereafter. All that being said, setting fire to a car as a diversion so you can orchestrate a theft seems like an incredibly stupid plan, since Curtis wound up calling the fire department, and I don't think you'd want to be breaking into vending machines with all those extra people on the scene. The timeline prior to Curtis's actual disappearance is a bit jumbled, as we have some workers who claim they saw Curtis walking around the facility at 3:15 a.m., which could imply that he was about to walk in on the people at the vending machines. But the security supervisor says he checked in on Curtis at the guard shack at around 3:25, so I wonder if someone is mistaken about the exact time. Curtis was first noticed to be missing at 3:45, and shortly before that is when the foreman thought he saw two vehicles speeding out of the factory's parking lot. So if the police's theory about Curtis being killed while interrupting a theft is correct, then you can infer that the drivers of those vehicles were transporting his body off the premises. But if this scenario is correct, then the big question is, can Robert April's whereabouts be accounted for during this time period? If April or anyone else suddenly disappeared from the factory during the middle of the shift, you'd think that his co-workers would have noticed. During numerous interviews about the case, Lieutenant Gallagher has made reference to a quote-unquote code of silence and once stated, quote, "Trust me, the Mafia's code of silence has nothing on the one you'll find in Seabrook," end quote. The implication seems to be that many people from the area knew exactly what happened to Curtis but none of them are willing to come forward and go on the record. I already talked about April allegedly bragging about Curtis's death while threatening David Horvitz, who would later recant his story on the witness stand. Well, guess what? This is not the only criminal trial against April which fell apart after a crucial witness backed out. In July of 2001, April was arrested and charged with one count of burglary and two counts of criminal threatening after he allegedly broke into a home and threatened two people with a knife. But the charges against him would eventually be dismissed when the home's owner ignored a subpoena and failed to show up in court to testify against April as the key witness for the prosecution. And in August of 2013, April wound up having a run-in with the law for entirely different reasons after his 19-year-old son, Robert April IV, was arrested for stabbing his father in the temple. The injuries turned out to be non-life-threatening, and I've been unable to find out how this particular case ultimately turned out, but it seems like trouble just happens to follow Robert April III everywhere he goes. Over the years, it sounds like both law enforcement and the Pichon family have repeatedly heard stories from many different sources about what April allegedly did to Curtis, but these sources are either anonymous or just passing along third-hand information. No one has been able to provide hard, solid evidence to implicate anyone, and unfortunately, you cannot get a search warrant or make an arrest based on unsubstantiated hearsay, no matter how many times the exact same story is spread around. But when you consider the fact that no less than two unrelated criminal cases against Robert April have fallen apart because key witnesses have flaked out, this gives off the impression that he knows how to frighten and intimidate people, and this might explain why no one has been willing to come forward and go on the record about Curtis's disappearance. Now, even if April is the guilty party, it sounds like he did not act alone. While Lieutenant Gallagher considers April to be the primary person of interest, he thinks that at least one other factory worker was involved. This unnamed accomplice might not have been physically involved in Curtis's murder, but at the very least, he likely participated in the theft and the cover-up. During the earliest media coverage of this case, it was reported that all of the factory workers who were working the graveyard shift that night were accounted for, but that statement is a bit vague. One of the anonymous tipsters who called the Pichon family's tip line said that the perpetrators hid Curtis's body inside a union office used for storage, which might explain why its door was found kicked in. But when exactly did they remove his body? Once the morning shift arrived, I'm sure there would have been a lot more people at the factory, making it more difficult to smuggle Curtis off the premises undetected. While Curtis was discovered to be missing from the guard shack at 3:45, it sounds like the police were not actually notified until his relief showed up at 5:30. Theoretically, if the two cars seen speeding out of the parking lot belonged to April and his accomplice, then they may have used this opportunity to dispose of Curtis's body and then made it back to the factory before the police arrived, where they could have claimed they were working the entire time. If this is what happened, then you have to wonder, how many of their co-workers noticed their absences? Did any of them have an inkling that they might have killed someone? Even if they had no direct involvement, it's possible that at least some of the co-workers who were there that night might know more than they're letting on, but they're either too afraid to say anything, or are following the aforementioned quote-unquote code of silence. As of right now, it seems like this has become one of those missing persons cases which has pretty much been solved in the minds of law enforcement and the victim's family, but they just lack a body or enough definitive evidence to arrest anyone for the crime. The disappearance seemed truly baffling and perplexing at the time it originally happened, but the more you put the pieces of the puzzle together, the more likely it seems that this case has a pretty simple solution involving foul play. Even though the phrase, "they stumbled upon something they weren't supposed to," has almost become cliched in true crime circles during the analysis of cold cases, I do think it applies to this case. Prior to his disappearance, Curtis expressed his fear that he did not have any backup on this particular shift in case something went wrong, and sadly, it sounds like his fears were not unfounded. Even though investigators do not believe the perpetrators intended to kill Curtis, it sounds like they still made the conscious choice to violently attack a person who was suffering from multiple sclerosis and could not adequately defend themselves, and that is truly despicable. If the theory presented by the police is true, and they are correct about the identity of the primary person of interest, then this definitely seems like one of the more solvable cases ever featured on The Trail Went Cold. 20 years is way too long for Curtis's family to have gone without recovering his remains, so all they might need is for the right person to come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Curtis Pichon, please contact the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit at 603-271-2663. That's 603-271-2663. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Also, I'd like to provide a plug for a website, which I've previously mentioned on this podcast, and that's lostandfoundblogs.com. It features an article about Curtis Pichon's disappearance, as well as some very detailed articles about other prominent cold cases which have been featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and contain exclusive, never-before-heard information. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about an unsolved mystery from the life of the most famous mystery writer of all time, Agatha Christie, who went missing in 1926 before she resurfaced 11 days later, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of how and why she disappeared. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Janelle A., David Q., and Ilsa L. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast. Excuse me, that's illegal.
Oh, hey there. You like true crime stories, right? Yeah, I know. Who doesn't? But I gotta admit, after a while, all those stories of murder and heartache, well, they tend to go straight to my hips. So that's why I, Leroy Luna, have created a podcast called Excuse Me, That's Illegal, where we'll take a hardcore look at some softcore crimes. No TED Talks on Bundy here. The letters BTK won't be coming from these lips. Unless he had a brother that used to steal library books. Suppose I'd be willing to go balls deep into that one if that were the case. Anyways, you'll hear stories such as The Mad Pooper, a female jogger who wreaked havoc in a Colorado Springs neighborhood, using one family's front yard as her own personal dumping grounds. If this kind of content sounds like it's up your alley, Excuse Me, That's Illegal is available right now on all your favorite podcatchers. So come join me. I'll be right here waiting for you.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And since we have entered the month of October, per tradition, we are going to spend the rest of the month releasing episodes about creepy unsolved mysteries which have some sort of Halloween slant to them. So I hope you have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for our first Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.